Today's speakers are Lou Anne Vanderpool from US EPA Region 5 office and Rob Greenwald of Geotrans. Lou Anne is a hydrogeologist in the EPA's Region 5 Superfund program in Chicago. She has over 20 years of experience with hydrogeologic investigations, groundwater contaminant fate and transport evaluations, and the design, implementation, and performance assessment of groundwater cleanups. Rob Greenwald has more than 20 years of experience in optimization of groundwater extraction and treatment systems, capture zone evaluation, numerical modeling, hydrogeologic evaluations, and project management. He's the primary author of a recently published EPA document on capture zone evaluation for pump and treat systems. And he's presented short courses on capture zone analysis to numerous EPA offices and state agencies. He has also co-managed a nationwide optimization project for groundwater pump and treat systems and has participated in over 50 RSEs at Superfund, DOE, RCRA, and US sites. So before I turn it over to Lou Anne, I remind phone participants to put your phones on mute, and if you don't have a mute button, hit the star 6 now, and again, please don't put us on hold. Thank you for your attention, Lou Anne.
Thank you, Linda. If we could please advance to slide 2, we'll get started here. Hydraulic containment of contaminated groundwater, what we call plume capture sometimes, is one of the main objectives of a pump and treat system. Hydraulic containment can be used to control the leading edge of a plume, protect actual or potential receptors, and to prevent the continued migration of contamination in the aquifer. It can also be used to control groundwater in contact with the source area. As part of the Superfund remedy reforms, EPA undertook a project to optimize fund lead pump and treat systems across the country. Each system was evaluated and analyzed by a formal process called a remediation system evaluation, which considered both the extraction and the treatment components. One of the most common recommendations identified during these RSEs was the need to improve capture zone analysis. We could go to the next slide, slide 3. The RSEs identified a variety of issues involving capture zone. These issues included inadequate target capture zone definition, particularly in the three dimensions, the lack of updating any modeling done with operating information, relying on water elevations measured in extraction wells when interpreting water levels, confusing drawdown with capture, collecting inadequate or inappropriate data for analysis. If we go to the next slide, number 4. Regional EPA hydrogeologists who work together as a group called the Groundwater Forum identified the need to develop a systematic approach to evaluate capture zones and pump and treat sites. This was in response to the conclusions of the RSC studies. The Groundwater Forum, along with EPA Office of Research and Development and Headquarters, collaborated on the production of a document for improving capture zone evaluation. This document was recently published in January 2008. Supporting that document, classroom-style training has been conducted in EPA's regional offices, at national project manager meetings, and in several states. The final training effort is the Internet course, such as today's presentation. If we could go to the next slide, slide 5. This slide lists several reference documents. The first bullet represents the document I was just talking about, a systematic approach for evaluation of capture zones and pump and treat systems. The second two documents are older documents, however, they are still relevant, and to make them handy for you, we're including them here. One of the primary authors of the capture zone document, as well as the main instructor for today's classroom training, is Rob Greenwald, who is today's seminar trainer. Rob will continue the presentation with the next slide.
Thank you, Lou Anne. I've moved on to slide number 6, and that simply provides an outline of what we're going to be discussing this afternoon. First, we'll talk a little bit about exactly what is a capture zone and why is it important for us to care about them and to evaluate capture. And then we'll get into the heart of the systematic approach, which is the six basic steps to capture zone analysis. And we will use a series of schematic figures and examples to illustrate the key concepts. At the bottom of slide number six, it notes that we are discussing systems here that behave like a porous media. So we're not addressing things like a fractured bedrock system or a karst-dominated system. It's not to say that some of the techniques and approaches we will talk about today can't be applied to those systems. It's just there's other more sophisticated considerations that also have to go into or that have to be considered in those cases. And the document that was recently published simply doesn't go into those complexities. So we won't be discussing those today. If we move on to slide number seven, this is also simply a note to indicate that the published document that Luann just referenced is quite lengthy and contains a good deal more complexity than what we will do in the two-hour session today. So we simply refer you to that document if you want to see more figures, more schematics, and examples from a series of sites in that document. There are three hypothetical case study sites and two real-world case study sites that go into quite a bit of detail. So we just wanted to point out, for those of you who want more after seeing this seminar, that there is more detail provided in the actual published document. And part of that detail goes into specific issues, such as some of the three-dimensional aspects of capture, the impacts of perhaps an off-site pumping well that turns on and off could impact capture, or the impacts of heterogeneity in the hydraulic connectivity distribution. Special issues like that are covered in a little more detail. Moving on to slide number eight, what is a capture zone? We refer to a capture zone as the three-dimensional region that contributes to groundwater extracted by one or more wells or drains. And we're using the term capture zone to be synonymous with the term hydraulic containment. And both of those words are important, hydraulic containment, because you can have a remedy that provides containment, such as a permeable reactive barrier wall, for instance. That might provide containment, but that's not providing hydraulic containment because the water continues to flow through the wall. When we talk about a capture zone, we're talking about a zone of hydraulic containment, and that's illustrated on the next slide, which would be slide number nine. Slide number nine, there are two figures. The one on the top is a map view. One on the bottom is a cross-sectional view, and we'll talk about the top portion first. Here we're illustrating on a map view what a capture zone might look like for a very simple case. There is a pumping well indicated with a green symbol, like a round symbol. There are lines of equal water level, which some people would refer to as water level contours or equipotential contours or hydraulic head contours. For the purposes of this presentation, we will use the same, we'll say all those things mean the same thing, just for simplicity. Those are the vertical lines that are labeled from right to left, 988, 986, 984, etc. Groundwater, in most systems, the flow lines will flow perpendicular to the lines of equal water elevation. And the flow lines in this case are represented by the dark black lines with the arrows at the end of them. And what you see on this figure is that some of the groundwater flow lines that are inside the green shaded area end up at the pumping well. Those are within the capture zone of the well. Some of the other flow lines, represented by the lines at the left of the figure, are flowing by the pumping well. They are not within the capture zone of the well. Looking at the bottom part of slide number nine is a cross-sectional view. And here we see an extraction well, which is a vertical line in the middle of the figure. And the screen interval is located by horizontal hatched lines. And you'll note on this particular example that this is a partially penetrating well, meaning the screen interval of the well does not penetrate the whole thickness of the aquifer. On this cross-sectional figure, the vertical extent of the capture zone is illustrated by the green shaded area. And you'll note in this schematic example, the capture zone does not extend the full thickness of the aquifer. And that is a possibility when you have partially penetrating wells. And the concept that we want to get across here is the depth to which the capture zone will extend is a function of the vertical anisotropy of the aquifer, which has to do with the ratio of the horizontal hydraulic conductivity to the vertical hydraulic conductivity. The more those two hydraulic conductivities are similar to each other, meaning the closer that anisotropy ratio is to 1, the deeper the capture zone will extend. But as the vertical anisotropy becomes greater, meaning the horizontal hydraulic conductivity is much larger than the vertical hydraulic conductivity, the partially penetrating well will tend to capture a shallower and shallower portion of the aquifer. Moving on to slide number 10. This slide introduces two terms that we will use in a great deal during this seminar, the target capture zone and the actual capture zone. The target capture zone is that portion of the aquifer that we're trying to capture with our extraction system. The actual capture zone is what we interpret to be the zone that is actually being captured. And the process of doing a capture zone analysis is the process of interpreting what the actual extent of capture is and comparing that to a target capture zone to determine whether we're successful or whether we need to make some changes. Moving on to slide number 11. This slide indicates some things that as a project manager or somebody responsible for a pump and treat system, some key aspects that you should be considering as your system moves into the operating and O&M phase. There are many ways in which the actual system that's put in the ground and turned on may differ from what was designed. The top bullet indicates one of the key aspects, which is that the extraction wells or the extraction rates may not be as originally designed. The well locations may have been moved because of access limitations and the like. And the rates may be different because the aquifer may not produce what was originally intended or for other reasons, such as well fouling. So at the bottom, we list some of the factors that you might want to consider. One of those being system downtime. Some systems operate 98-99% of the time, but it's quite common for other systems to only operate perhaps 85% or 90% of the time. And that obviously has implications for the extent of capture. It may not be the whole system. It may be that individual pumping wells are down a part of the time. Another thing to consider is whether or not there are time-varying influences. Many sites around the country have seasonal impacts due to irrigation pumping or irrigation recharge or times of drought, seasons of drought and seasons of rainy conditions when recharge conditions change. Other sites are influenced by tides, so there might be a high tide condition and a low tide condition where the hydraulic gradients may be substantially different. Declining well yields due to fouling is a very common issue at many pump and treat systems. A pumping well that once yielded 100 gallons per minute may over time only be able to yield 80 or 60 or 40 gallons per minute. And that may require well maintenance to restore it, but for that period of time when the well is producing less water, that may need to be considered with regards to the overall extent of capture that's being achieved. And of course there are geologic heterogeneities that are a reality in real systems that may not have been considered during, a model that was made during a system design, and that points to the need to do a capture zone analysis after the system is put in the ground and turned on based on real operational data and not based on assumed data, that's assuming that everything is going to go to plan once the system is turned on. Moving on to slide number 12. This is a schematic figure that illustrates really what we're all trying to avoid. In this schematic, the plume is represented with various shades of green and blue. There is a target capture zone represented with a solid blue line. And the actual capture zone from the three extraction wells is indicated with a couple of black lines. And in this case, what you see is there is a gap in capture between two of the extraction wells that allows the plume to continue to migrate towards a receptor. That is obviously what it is we're trying to avoid when we do a pump and treat system. It allows the plume to grow. It may obviously impact receptors in a negative way. It may cause us to have to do what's called chasing the plume, either with the addition of more monitoring points, and perhaps even more costly, the addition of extraction wells, further down gradient, and the associated infrastructure. So this obviously increases the time frame of the remedy and obviously increases the cost of the remedy. Moving on to slide number 13. This slide lists the six basic steps that comprise the systematic evaluation of capture zones. We'll obviously be talking about each one of these steps during the course of the presentation this afternoon. But this slide simply gives an overview of them. Steps 1 and 2 are what I would call the preliminary steps, reviewing the site data, the site conceptual model, and the remedy objectives in step 1. And then step 2 is to define the site-specific target capture zone, or perhaps capture zones. Steps 3, 4, and 5 are more of the technical meat of the analysis. Step 3 is all about water levels. Step 4 is all about performing calculations that range from simple to complex. And step 5 is about evaluating trends based on the water quality data. And then step 6 is where all of that information is brought together. The actual extent of capture is interpreted based on the steps 3, 4, and 5 and compared to the target capture zone. Uncertainties are assessed. The need to fill data gaps is determined. That all occurs in step 6. And again, we'll talk about each one of these in more detail as we go through this afternoon. At the bottom of slide 13, this term converging lines of evidence is introduced. And that is discussed a little more on the next slide, which is slide number 14. The concept of converging lines of evidence is not dissimilar from a murder case that's based on circumstantial evidence. In such a case, there is no smoking gun per se. Rather, there's different lines of evidence that are all brought together so that when all those lines of evidence are considered, it becomes, you determine whether or not the person is guilty or innocent. Well, a capture zone analysis is in many ways similar to that type of circumstantial evidence murder trial. Usually, any one water level map or any one piece of water quality data is not sufficient to adequately determine whether or not you have successful capture. Rather, you need to look at a series of lines of evidence. That's why we look at all of those different types of features, water levels, water quality, and make calculations. The more lines of evidence we have that support our conclusions, the more confidence we have. I'm now moving on to slide number 15. Which is a flowchart, which is in this presentation because I was told that every presentation needs to have a flowchart. I want to point your attention to the two diamonds in this flowchart. At the top diamond, it says, are there data gaps that make conclusion of the capture evaluation uncertain? And that's a very important question to be asked. And notice how the question does not say, is there uncertainty? Because clearly, if we ask the question, is there uncertainty, the answer would always be yes. Rather, the correct question is, are those uncertainties such that they call into question the very conclusions of our analysis? If the answer to that question is yes, then there is a need to fill those data gaps and redo the capture zone evaluation after those data gaps are filled. However, if we resolve that there are some uncertainties, but because we have enough lines of evidence, we feel good about our conclusions, then the answer to that question would be no, and our capture zone evaluation can be completed, and we can ask the second question, which is our capture successful? And that involves comparing our interpreted extent of capture three-dimensionally to our target capture zone. If we answer no, that capture is not successful, that indicates the need to, in some manner, optimize our extraction system. It might mean adding new extraction wells. It might mean increasing the rates at existing extraction wells. It might mean adding injection wells to help assist with the control of the hydraulic gradient. If the answer to the question is yes, that capture is successful, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're completely done. There's still a need to continue routine monitoring and to periodically perform capture zone evaluations. We'll talk about the frequency of capture zone evaluations towards the end of this presentation. If capture is successful, there may also be the opportunity to optimize the extraction network to reduce costs by either removing some of the extraction wells or by reducing the extraction rates. And that will be a somewhat site-specific analysis depending on the cost of the system and whether it is, there's a lot of bang for the buck for reducing the cost, which depends on the specific treatment technology and other costs that are associated with the system. Moving on to slide number 16, this will bring us to our first question and answer period. So I'll turn it back over to Linda for that.
Thank you, Rob. I don't have any questions right now from our simulcast listeners, I should say. If you have a question, please click on the question icon and type in your question. If you're on the phone, you may unmute your phone by hitting #6 and ask your question, and I'll take questions from the phone if there are any.
I have much fewer hours, but see, here's what might give me. This is the reversed.
I'm sorry, is that a question someone has, or they just forgot to put their phone on mute?
No, I'm sorry. Okay, see, 17898.
Okay, do we have any questions from our on the phone for Rob or for Luann?
And then there's a $1,000.
If we're getting some background noise, could the person talking please make sure their phone is on mute by hitting *6?
I need to buy a software.
Hey, Rob, I don't think we're going to have any questions at this point, so why don't we continue?
Fantastic. And this is a very general part of the presentation, and there will be two more question and answer periods after we talk about some of the more technical details. So that works out great. So I'm going to move on to slide number 17.
Yeah.
This is where we're going to start talking about the six basic steps that comprise the systematic evaluation
so
of capture.
Can
the person who's talking please either stop talking or put your phone on mute?
Hey, Rob, what I think I'll do is I'm going to mute everybody and ask you, I'm going to hit *5, and I'm going to ask you to hit #6 to unmute.
Is it #6 or *6?
Moving hours until we got to this. I thought that this was the final.
I think it's #.
Okay, I'll give that a whirl.
The leader has muted your line.
Rob, are you back on?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so let us continue now. I'm going to move on to slide number 18. Step one of the six steps is, again, a preliminary step. And it has to do with reviewing site data, the site conceptual model, and the objectives of the pump and treat system portion of the remedy. So part of step one is to determine if your plume is adequately delineated in three dimensions. And I think this should be obvious to most of you that if your plume is not well delineated, it's very difficult to determine what the target capture zone would have to be. The only caveat I would say here is that in some cases, a pump and treat system may be part of an interim remedy. In that case, the overall plume may not be fully delineated, but the source area might be. And in that case, the source area might be delineated well enough to go ahead and install a pump and treat system and do the capture zone analysis. At the bottom of this slide, it indicates some of the types of hydrogeologic information that are generally required to do a capture zone evaluation. You generally need to have some knowledge of the hydraulic conductivity values and whether that hydraulic conductivity is somewhat uniform or homogeneous or whether it varies considerably over space. A number of methods are used to determine the hydraulic conductivity. To be as simple as looking at Fries and Cherry textbook of what the typical hydraulic conductivity is of a sand versus a clay versus a silt. Also used are looking at regional water supply reports from things like USGS water supply papers, for instance. Obviously, people do slug tests and aquifer tests. Slug tests tend to be less reliable than pumping tests. Because a pumping test tends to give you a more representative value of not just the immediate vicinity of the well, but of the aquifer surrounding the well. So many people ask, which do you prefer? I generally would prefer pumping tests. After that, some combination of slug tests and other types of information, like I discussed, are generally next in the pecking order. The hydraulic gradient is something that has both a magnitude and a direction. So I wanted to make sure everybody understands that when people refer to a hydraulic gradient, they often refer to it as a number, but that number also should go along with a direction. What direction is groundwater flowing? And that may change over space and over time. The aquifer thickness is important to know for doing some of the calculations. The pumping rates and the locations of pumping wells are clearly important when doing a capture zone evaluation. Groundwater elevation measurements, clearly needed if you want to make water level maps. Water quality data over time, clearly needed if you want to evaluate concentration trends. And the well construction data refers to simple things like the X and Y coordinates of the well, but also would refer to things like the top of casing so that the water levels can be calculated from a depth to water measurement. Also would pertain to the screen interval of the well, which is very important because when you're evaluating, for instance, a water level map, you might want to go back and verify that all of those water levels pertain to the same hydrostratigraphic unit. And to make those types of evaluations, you need to know what the screen intervals of the wells are in conjunction with the geologic layering. Moving on to slide number 19. Another part of step one is to evaluate the adequacy of the site conceptual model. Some people also refer to this as a conceptual site model. I've seen it both ways. This is not in any way a numerical model. The conceptual site model is, or site conceptual model, is really a series of text descriptions in coordination with figures and tables that explain the site. They explain where water is traveling. How did the contaminants get into the groundwater, and where are the contaminants moving towards? Where are the potential receptors? How long will it take? Do we think it will take to get there? It's an overall explanation of the hydrogeology of the site and the fate and transport of the contaminants. And again, there will always be uncertainty in the site conceptual model. The question is there a reasonable site conceptual model for this site that adequately explains the observations of the contaminants and where they're moving? And if you can't answer very basic questions, such as how did the contaminants get in the ground, and where are the receptors, and how fast is groundwater flowing, it can be very difficult to do an adequate capture zone evaluation. Moving on to slide number 20. Another part of step one, which is this preliminary step, is to clearly understand the goals of the remedy with respect to hydraulic containment. And the key questions here are listed here on this slide, which is, is the goal complete hydraulic containment of the contaminant plume, or is the goal of the remedy partial hydraulic containment, only containing a part of the plume, where the rest of the plume is going to be addressed in some other manner? And these questions have to be asked for both the horizontal flow direction and the vertical flow direction. And the next couple of slides are a series of schematics to illustrate these points. So moving on to slide number 21. My presentation isn't moving to slide 21. There we go. Sorry about that. I'll be back in a second. All right, I'm slide number 21. Hopefully you're all there with me. Again, there's two figures, a top and a bottom on slide 21. These are both map views, but they're illustrating different types of remedy goals. In the top portion of the figure, we're looking at a map view. We've got a receptor on the left-hand side of the slide, and we have a plume on the right-hand side of the slide. Flow, regional flow of groundwater is from right to left. For this particular scenario, there is a target capture zone or a hypothetical capture zone drawn around the entire plume. This is representing a goal in this case that's saying the goal of this particular system is to capture the entire plume hydraulically. On the bottom part of this figure is a different type of remedy goal, which is also quite common. In this particular case, the goal of the remedy is not to capture hydraulically the entire plume, it's just to capture the most impacted part of the plume. And there is another portion of the plume which may be left to be addressed by some other means. It may be addressed by some other remediation technology, such as, say, in-situ bioremediation, or it may be addressed with something like monitored natural attenuation. It certainly does not mean that we're going to do nothing about that portion of the plume that is not hydraulically captured. It just means it's being addressed in some other manner. Both of these types of goals are quite common. Linda, you may note that somebody indicated they had lost audio. I'm assuming that's not a generic problem, but a specific problem.
Okay, we'll look into that. Thank you.
Moving on to slide number 22, that is this is a similar slide, but in this slide we're looking at the vertical direction rather than horizontal direction. So again, there's two portions of this slide, a top and a bottom. These are both cross-sectional views. And looking at the top figure, just to orient you, we're looking at a case where we have a shallow aquifer and a deeper aquifer, and they're separated by what's labeled the semi-confining unit. We have a plume, which is located in the shallow aquifer. That's represented by the green shading. And we have on the left-hand side of the figure a potential receptor located in the deeper aquifer. Now, again, the purpose of this slide is to illustrate goals of the remedy with respect to hydraulic containment. On the top portion, you'll see a big horizontal red arrow pointing to the right. That is representing a goal of hydraulic capture in the horizontal direction, meaning we don't want this plume to continue to migrate to the left towards that receptor. Then you'll see a series of three red arrows pointing upward from the lower aquifer to the upper aquifer. That is representing, in this case, a goal of hydraulic capture in the vertical direction, meaning the goal of this remedy would be to make sure the water levels in the lower aquifer are always higher than the water levels in the upper aquifer so that the flow direction is upward. Now, that is not always the goal. So the bottom part of this figure represents an alternate form of a remedy with a different set of goals. In this case, the setup is basically the same, and the horizontal goal is still in place. But in this case, no vertical goal of hydraulic capture is implemented. Rather, the portion of the plume that might flow downward into the deeper aquifer might be addressed with some other technology. It might be addressed with monitoring. It might be addressed with an entirely different remedial technique that's active. But in this case, the goal would not be hydraulic containment in the vertical. So, again, the goal is very important to understand. It may represent the entire plume. It may represent just a portion of the plume. Moving on to slide number 23. We now move to step number 2, which is define a target capture zone. The target capture zone identifies where specifically we're trying to achieve hydraulic capture. And it should be obvious that this flows directly from the goals that we just discussed. If the goal is complete hydraulic capture of the plume, that will help identify where the target capture zone needs to be. If the goal is to only capture the most contaminated portion of the plume, and then some other aspect of the remedy will address the remaining portion of the plume, then the target capture zone will take that into consideration, and the determination will be, well, what specific portion of the plume do we need to capture hydraulically? Ideally, the target capture zone will be clearly stated on maps or cross-sections. For instance, it's always very helpful if you see, for instance, a water level map and the zone of capture is interpreted, it's really great to throw the target capture zone right on that map so you can see how you're doing with respect to the goal. The target capture zone may be as simple as a geographical boundary. It might be, we don't want the plume to go past this road, or we don't want the plume to go past our site fence. Alternatively, the target capture zone may be defined by a specific concentration contour, such as the 5 part per billion contour of TCE, or perhaps the 100 part per billion contour of TCE if you're only capturing a portion of the plume. It must be noted, however, that if it's based on a concentration contour, that those concentration contours may change over time for a whole variety of reasons. They might change because new monitoring wells are added. They might change because the pumetry system is having an impact on the water quality over time. They might change because new sources are introduced to the aquifer. Many reasons. So it's just important to note, if you make a target capture zone based on a plume boundary or a specific concentration contour, that may need to be modified over time. It's also noted on this slide that if you're looking at specific concentration contours, that you really need to go back and look at all the different compounds. Many times there are multiple compounds at a site, but reports will only contain the plume maps for specific indicator compounds. But it's important to go back and look at those other compounds, make sure they all fall within the target capture zone sufficiently. Moving on to slide number 24. Again, my computer is taking some amount of time to do that, so I apologize. Here we go. There are two parts to this slide. There's a top and a bottom. Top is a map view. The bottom is a cross-sectional view. And this is simply showing how a target capture zone could be schematically represented on a figure. In a map view, in this particular case, the target capture zone is being drawn around the entire horizontal extent of the plume. That's on the top. On the bottom part of this figure, which is, again, a cross-section similar to what we were looking at before, you'll notice that the target capture zone is drawn on the down gradient side of the plume. That's the vertical part of the line. And then there's a horizontal line that's drawn along the top of the semi-confining unit. And when drawing the target capture zone this way, it would imply that we have a target capture zone in the vertical direction, which would imply that we have a goal of maintaining an upward hydraulic gradient from the lower aquifer to the upper aquifer. That's what drawing that horizontal line along the top of the semi-confining unit illustrates in this case. Moving on to slide number 25. Now we've talked a little bit about our two preliminary steps. Step one was all about, the goals and the site conceptual model and the plume delineation and do we have enough data. Step two is all about specifying what our target capture zone is going to be three-dimensionally. So now we're moving into the more analytical steps of evaluating the actual extent of capture. And step number three is all about water levels. Water levels are evaluated in several different ways. You can make horizontal maps to show how water is flowing in a map view. You can also make head difference maps of the difference in head between one aquifer and an underlying or overlying aquifer to show where water is flowing up and where water is flowing down. You can also look at pairs of water levels, which are sometimes called gradient control points, to determine if water flows, what the flow direction is from one point to another point. For instance, at a site boundary, you can determine if water is flowing inward or outward relative to a site boundary. Or at a location, for instance, where the aquifer is connected to a surface water body, such as a stream, you can make a determination, is water flowing from the aquifer into the stream, or is water flowing from the stream into the aquifer? So we'll talk a little bit about all these different types of water level interpretations. I'm now moving on to slide number 26. This slide indicates that installing water level measurement points is generally inexpensive. And, of course, that word generally has to be caveated at some sites. It's generally inexpensive to put in a simple point to measure water level. But at some sites where the water level might be 200 or 300 feet below ground surface, that might be quite expensive. Or if you're working, for instance, at a nuclear facility where there's many other considerations involved in drilling anything, it may be quite expensive. But at the vast majority of sites, it's inexpensive. One of the things that is done in this capture zone document is we refer to the term piezometer as a location where only water levels will be measured and not water quality. It generally would have a short screen interval in addition. The reason we use this terminology is because there is many times a hesitancy on the part of a responsible party to add monitoring locations to the ground, not because they're expensive to drill, but because they're expensive to monitor water quality repetitively over time. However, if there's some agreement among site stakeholders that this measurement point will only be used to monitor water levels over time and not water quality, there might be less reluctance to add some of these points. And therefore, we use this term piezometer to refer to a location where only water levels will be measured to augment the capture zone evaluation. Another note is that it's very useful for the person in the field who's measuring water levels to have a table that would indicate the range of depth to water that's typically observed at that well. That's what's measured in the field. You don't go in the field and measure the water level elevation. What you measure in the field is the depth to water from a specific point, like the top of the PVC casing. That field technician, if there's an anomalous value, the problem is once they're done collecting the water levels, they might send the data back to the office, and that person evaluating it might say, boy, this water level looks really strange. The problem is you really can't go back and redo that water level elevation and get the contemporaneous nature of those water levels intact. So it's very helpful to have the sampling technician be able to determine that there's an anomalous value right there in the field, but because they know what the historical range is, then they can resolve the issue right then and there in the field. And the bottom part of the slide indicates that periodic well surveys are recommended. This doesn't mean that every time you go out and do, make a water level map, you have to go resurvey the wells. It's just perhaps every 5 years or so, it's not a bad idea to go and resurvey all the wells, because in many sites, wells were installed by a different series of drillers and contractors. They were surveyed at different times. Some wells may be subject to frost heaving and the like. And in some cases, I have seen instances where historically some of the wells were surveyed and some of the wells, the elevations were estimated when they were drilled based on topographic contours. Sometimes those distinctions get lost over time. So it's just good practice to periodically resurvey the top of casing elevations and the horizontal locations. Moving on to slide number 27. Making contour maps from water levels is somewhat of a combination of art and science. Some people do this contouring by hand, and some people do it with software. Some people do a combination of both, where they use software, but they help it along by adding extra data points. Those are called control points. So I wanted to point that out, that it is possible to use software but add points to help the contours look the way you would draw them as a hydrogeologist. All I would point out is that if you do such a practice, I would advise you indicate somewhere in the report what those points were and why they were added. One of the advantages of doing contouring by hand is that it allows the insight of the hydrogeologist to come full force. The hydrogeologist knows more than just a computer package doing contouring. The hydrogeologist knows where, say, a surface water body is. The hydrogeologist knows which way the plume has migrated over time and the like. However, the software has its advantages, too, and one of those is highlighted by the figure on this slide on the right, which shows gradient vectors. You may not be able to see it that clearly, but I'm sure you can get the idea, which is the software can indicate the direction and the magnitude of the hydraulic gradient over space to help illustrate where the capture zone of each individual extraction well is. One way to determine whether or not your contouring method is appropriate is to actually add a little bit of redundancy. If you're drawing the contour maps by hand, you might consider giving the water level data to two different analysts and have them each draw the capture zone individually and then compare to see how similar or different they are. If you're using software, you might consider using different mathematical algorithms and see how similar or different the results are. Moving on to slide number 28. This slide indicates one of the most critical pitfalls that was observed during the remediation system evaluations that Luann mentioned earlier. And this has to do with what is called the well losses or well inefficiencies at the pumping wells. The problem occurs because a water level measured inside the pumping well generally is not representative of the water level in the aquifer immediately outside of the pumping well. And that's what's being illustrated on this figure. On this figure, the vertical cylinder, let's say, or the it's labeled extraction well, and there's a big red arrow coming out of the top of it to represent the water coming out of the extraction well. And you'll notice that there's an upside-down triangle indicating the water level inside the pumping well. Then you'll notice there's a piezometer just to the left of the extraction well, and there is a water level indicated for the piezometer as well. And you'll notice that the piezometer water level is substantially higher than the water level inside the pumping well. That difference is what people call well losses and well inefficiencies. And it, many people disagree on the use of those terms, so we won't get into that here. For the purposes of this discussion, let's just recognize that the water levels in the pumping wells are frequently much lower than the water level in the surrounding aquifer. And the causes of it are poor or inadequate development of the well, biofouling that occurs or encrustation of the well screen, or turbulent flow across the well screen. All of these things lead to the fact that the well is, it's easier for the pump to get the water from inside the well casing than it is to get it from the adjacent aquifer material. And that's what causes these well inefficiencies and well losses. It notes at the bottom of this slide that it's best to have piezometers near each extraction well so you know exactly what the water level in the aquifer is. There are many references that you can look at that will discuss how to try to calculate what the water level in the aquifer is based on the water level in the pumping well. But all those calculations are subject to a significant degree of uncertainty, and it's far better to have a piezometer near each extraction well. The next two slides illustrate the problem that is caused by using water levels at extraction wells. So if we move on to slide number 29, and this is based on a real-world site that I observed some years ago. On slide number 29, there's a plume highlighted in the green shading. There's a series of monitor wells, each of which has a water level posted next to it or beneath the well label. But you'll notice inside the plume, one of those wells is labeled EW1. That's an extraction well. And you'll see the water level at that extraction well is far lower than the water level in the other monitoring wells. The question is, how representative is the water level in the extraction well of the aquifer material immediately adjacent to the extraction well? And you can't tell on this slide. So the interpretation that was made at this particular site was as illustrated here. They drew essentially a bullseye for the water level contours and then interpreted the extent of capture being quite sufficient based on those water level contours. And those are represented by the dark lines with arrows on them. If we move on to the next slide, which is slide number 30, this shows how a different interpretation arises when a piezometer location is available near the extraction well. In this case, all of the water levels are the same, except that this new location, PZ1, is available and indicates the water level in the aquifer immediately adjacent to the pumping well. The water level at the pumping well itself is not used for contouring. And as you can see, when this new data point is available, it becomes quite apparent that a substantial amount of the water level in the extraction well, the reason it's so much lower than the surrounding water levels is due to well losses and well inefficiencies. And using this new piezometer, very little capture is apparent at this site. So these two slides go to show how important it is to have a water level measurement point adjacent to an extraction well and not at the extraction well. Slide number 31, I'm moving on to that now. This slide summarizes some of the key issues when evaluating potentiometric surface maps or water level maps. Are the number and distribution of measurement locations adequate? This is a question that is frequently asked. How many points do I need water level data at to make a good water level map? I think it's probably clear that that's a somewhat site-specific issue, but what is a general rule is that the more data points you have, the more accurate your contouring will be. The second box, are water levels included in the vicinity of the extraction wells? That's the issue we were just talking about. Using water levels directly measured at extraction wells can be quite problematic, and just throwing them out can be equally problematic. What you really want is a water level measurement at a location adjacent to the extraction well. You need to consider the three-dimensionality of the system. Has capture evaluation been performed for all the pertinent hydrogeologic units? Is there bias in the contouring algorithm? I talked about this earlier. The way you can get about that issue is by having multiple analysts create the water level maps or by using different mathematical algorithms to see how similar or different they are. And then, as we've mentioned before, transient impacts may be at play, and that needs to be considered. If you have a wet season and a dry season, and you're submitting an annual monitoring report, it is probably not appropriate to have one water level map. You probably need to have at least two, one representing the wet season and one representing the dry season. Similarly, if you're a tidally influenced site, it may not be appropriate to have one water level map. You may have to have one that represents a high tide condition and one that represents a low tide condition. Slide number 32 brings up another issue that was Luann mentioned earlier that was observed during some of the remediation system evaluations. And that is confusing the concept of drawdown with the concept of capture. At some sites, you'll hear the words, "I know we have good capture at this location because I know when we are pumping, we see drawdown here." And that's really not a valid statement. And this first slide, number 32, tries to illustrate why that is in a cross-sectional view. So to orient you to this figure, we have a pumping well labeled in green. The top line that slopes from the top right to the bottom left of your screen is labeled the static water table. That would be the water table that existed before we turned on this pumping well. And then the line below that represents the water level that results after the pumping well is turned on. And the difference between the static water table and the resulting water table is the drawdown caused by pumping. Now, you'll see on the left-hand side of this slide there's a vertical dashed line. To the right-hand side of that line, when the well is pumping, you'll see the hydraulic gradient is towards the pumping well. And on the left-hand side of that line, the hydraulic gradient is away from the pumping well. Now, on that portion of the slide, to the left of that vertical dashed line, there's blue text that says, "This area has observed drawdown, but is outside the capture zone." And that's the point, is that the capture zone is a combination, it's a superposition of the drawdown due to pumping superimposed on the background hydraulic gradient. In this case, when you move to the left of that vertical dashed line, the hydraulic gradient that's caused by the pumping well is not enough to overcome the background hydraulic gradient, which is towards the left. And therefore, in those locations, there is drawdown, but there is no capture. And that just illustrates why you can't say, "I have drawdown at this location, so I must be inside the capture zone." The next slide, slide number 33, illustrates the same point, just on a map view. So very quickly on this slide, you have the extraction well labeled in the middle. You have the water table contours that are labeled there are the resulting water level contours that are the superposition of the background hydraulic gradient plus the drawdown that's due to pumping. The drawdown contours are illustrated with the concentric blue dotted line. So what you will see is that there are areas, especially as you move to the left of the pumping well and to the north and south of the pumping well, there are there's a wide area that's inside those blue lines, meaning there is drawdown observed, but it's not within the capture zone. The capture zone, which is illustrated with the green shading, is a more oblong surface because it's measuring that result of the superposition of the hydraulic gradient with the drawdown. The only case where the capture zone will be the same as the cone of depression, which or the you know area where there's drawdown, is when there's absolutely no background hydraulic gradient. Very few sites have zero background hydraulic gradient. Moving on to slide number 34. This illustrates another type of analysis that can be done with water levels, and this has to do with water level pairs or gradient control pairs. This is where you're looking at specific points and determining whether flow is from one to the other or vice versa. So on this particular schematic, we have three pumping wells that are labeled with represented as round circles. And we have a property boundary which is labeled AA prime. And in this particular case, we're looking at five different pairs of water level measurement points. And you'll notice that three of those pairs are illustrating flow inward towards the pumping wells. The ones that are immediately down gradient of the pumping wells have the water level at the property boundary higher than the water level inside the property boundary, indicating inward flow with respect to the property boundary. The other two points, which are between the pumping wells, are illustrating the potential for outward flow because the water level inside the property boundary is higher than the water level outside the property or at the property boundary. Now, if you see this data, superimposed on these data are these dashed lines, which represent potential flow lines for this system. And what it's illustrating is that where those water level pairs are indicating outward flow, there still is the potential that that outward flow will still ultimately be captured effectively by this system. Many of you who have training in hydrogeology know that the capture zone of a well will extend beyond the actual location of the pumping well. So as illustrated here, they might curve back. But to make that determination for capture zone evaluation may require other lines of evidence. It might require some form of model. It might require some form of water quality data, and we'll talk about those types of data after the next question and answer period. Moving on to slide number 35. This is just some notes about these water level pair type of data that we were just referring to. As indicated on that schematic, the water level pairs are most likely to indicate outward flow between the pumping wells. That's going to be the area that's most sensitive for that type of analysis. One of the ways to make sure that doesn't happen is to increase the pumping rates. The more you increase the pumping rates, the more likely it's going to be that all of those gradient control pairs will indicate inward flow. However, increasing pumping rates is not necessarily the golden solution at every site. For one thing, it may substantially increase the cost of the pumping and the treatment. It may be technically impractical given constraints with regards to the pumping and treatment system itself, the piping and the tanks and the like. Similarly, increasing pumping rates can have other negative impacts. Sometimes it could have impacts such as dewatering well screens of nearby wells, whether those be household wells or irrigation wells. Increasing the pumping rate might dewater a wetlands, might draw in contamination from another site, might dewater the aquifer itself. So although increasing pumping rates is certainly something that can help add confidence in the evaluation, there need to be other considerations that are factored in before simply going ahead and increasing the pumping rates. Also noted at the bottom of this slide is that while the schematic we just looked at illustrated the use of gradient control pairs horizontally, they can also be used vertically at wells that are called clustered wells, where you have a cluster of wells where the screen interval is in different layers of an aquifer or perhaps in different aquifers, one above the other. And that, in that way, those gradient control pairs can be used to indicate locations where flow is upward versus where flow is downward. So at this point, we're through steps 1, 2, and 3, and we figured we would take some questions before moving on to steps 4, 5, and 6.
Thank you, Rob. We have some questions from people on the simulcast, which I will read. First question is from John Borthwick with Shaw Environmental. He asks, what is your opinion on locating piezometers in the filter pack versus, say, 5 or 10 feet away from the extraction well?
Okay, well, this is actually a question that's come up at a number of the training sessions that have gone on at the EPA regions, and I would say there's generally been a consensus that it's preferable to have those piezometers outside of the filter pack. So, you know, 5 or 10 feet away from the well is usually a better way to go. And the reason is that part of the well fouling issue that may be causing the well losses may be associated with the filter pack. So it's better to keep the piezometer outside of the filter pack.
Okay, thank you, Rob. I want to remind listeners that they can hit the question mark on their computer to submit a question on the that will be typed up for us. And when I go to the phones, you'll hit #6 to unmute your phone. I'll take questions from our phone audience. Are there any questions on the phone? Remember to hit #6 to unmute your phone. Okay, I'll go to the second question from our simulcast audience. This question is from Christopher Mulry with Groundwater and Environmental Services. He asks on slide 28, wouldn't inadequate well construction, screen and or filter pack design also be a potential, could be a potentially significant source of well inefficiency?
Yeah, that's it's an excellent point, and I absolutely agree that inadequate well construction is one of the causes of well inefficiency, and that can be manifested by using an improper, screen size, plot size. It could be using improper filter pack material. It can be inadequate, development of the well, if you leave a lot of mud in there from mud rotary drilling and the like. So, yes, certainly well construction of both the filter pack and the screen are also potentially significant causes.
Thank you, Rob. Are there any other questions from the phone? Okay. I'm going to mute all the lines again. Rob, I would like you to hit #6 after I've done that.
Okay. Can you hear me, Linda?
Yes, sure can.
Fantastic. Okay, I'm going to move on to slide number 37 now. We go into the back nine, so to speak, of the capture zone evaluation. Step number 4, performing calculations. Now, calculations can range from very simple calculations to very complex calculations. And which types of calculations are appropriate for a site will depend on how complex the site is. Some of the simple horizontal calculations we're going to talk about are called the estimated flow rate calculation and the capture zone width calculation. I'll talk a little bit about each of those. And then I'll talk a little bit about groundwater modeling in conjunction with particle tracking in particular, which generally would apply to more complex sites. We are certainly not suggesting that every site needs to have a complex three-dimensional groundwater flow model. Moving on to slide number 38. My computer is not quite there yet. There we go. First, we're going to talk about these simple horizontal calculations. As I mentioned, one of them is called the estimated flow rate calculation. That is a simple calculation that can be performed to calculate approximately how much pumping might be required to capture the extent of the plume horizontally. The second calculation, which is the capture zone width calculation, is that same calculation sort of turned around the other way. You know what the pumping rate is, and you're trying to estimate how wide the capture zone is going to be. So let's move on to slide number 39. For both of these calculations, there are a series of simplifying assumptions that must be made, and those assumptions are listed here. The aquifer is assumed to be homogeneous, isotropic, confined of infinite extent, with a uniform aquifer thickness, so a known constant value thickness, fully penetrating extraction wells, a uniform regional hydraulic gradient, meaning it does not change in space and it does not change in time. Steady state flow, again, meaning the flow system does not change in time, the pumping rates don't change, the water levels don't change, etc. Negligible vertical gradient, that there's no net recharge or that the recharge is being accounted for in the background hydraulic gradient. And there's no other sources or sinks of water, such as if you're pumping near a river, you're assuming that there's no contribution of a nearby river, for instance, to your pumping well, or there's no leakage from an aquifer above or below. So it's interesting because you look at this set of assumptions and you go, well, I certainly have never seen a site that meets all those assumptions. At the same point in time, we usually make many of these same assumptions when we do a pump test analysis. Maybe not all of them for specific analyses, but we generally assume many of them. So we need to remember that these assumptions are quite simplifying and will not apply at many sites. We need to remember that they're there, but we also generally want to go ahead and make these calculations just the same and then temper our results by how much our site does or does not conform to these assumptions. Moving on to slide number 40. Again, I'm sorry, but my computer is lagging behind. There we go. This slide illustrates the basis of the estimated flow rate calculation. You'll see the mathematical equation listed there at the top. Q is what we're trying to calculate. That's how much water we need to pump. The K is the hydraulic conductivity of the aquifer. The B is the saturated thickness of the aquifer. The width is the width of the plume as illustrated on a map. and the I is the magnitude of the background hydraulic gradient. You will also notice this other term tacked on at the end called factor. And factor is essentially, it's a fudge factor, it's a rule of thumb factor. What it means is that you can calculate how much water is flowing through the plume, but hydrogeologists just tend to know that if you want to capture the plume, you're probably going to have to pump more than what you calculate. So we generally add on this factor, which is, by rule of thumb, 1.5 to 2.0. That doesn't mean that's exactly what it is, and it doesn't mean that I can tell you at a specific site what that number should be. It just means that when we do this calculation, we usually throw on an additional fudge factor to account for the fact that we generally need to pump more than we calculate. And the reason we have to pump more is because there generally are other sources of water that we're not accounting for, such as leakage from a surface water body or leakage from an aquifer above or below. The schematic figures here illustrate some of the parameters, such as B being the aquifer thickness on the cross-sectional view, and the W being the plume width on the map view. We go to slide number 41. This simply illustrates this calculation with a series of parameter values. You'll notice on the slide previous that I indicated that the slide indicated that the units must be consistent. And what that means is that if your hydraulic connectivity is in units of feet per day, then all your length units need to be in feet, and all your time units need to be in days. So your width of your plume would have to be in feet, and your resulting Q would end up being in units of cubic feet per day. If you want your units in gallons per minute, you then have to convert your cubic feet per day pumping rate into gallons per minute. Using this example on slide number 41, the K is 28 feet per day, the B is 31 feet, that's the saturated thickness, the width of the plume is 1,000 feet, the background hydraulic gradient is 0.0033. So you can see, you go ahead and make the calculation that's indicated there. You simply substitute all those in, and then at the end, you convert from the cubic feet per day to gallons per minute. And what you get using these numbers is that the estimated amount of pumping capture 1,000 feet width of plume at this site would be 15 gallons per minute times whatever you assume for the factor. If you assume 1.0 for that fudge factor, you would need 15 gallons a minute. If you assume the factor is 1.5, you would need 22.5, and if the factor is 2.0, you would need 30. Now, the way you use this calculation is as follows. Let's say your actual pump and treat system is only pumping 8 gallons per minute. This would be one line of evidence that would say, well, we think we need to probably be pumping more on the order of 15 to 30 gallons per minute, but we're only pumping 8, so we're probably not pumping enough. If your actual pump and treat system was pumping 50 gallons per minute, you could look at this calculation and say, well, we probably only need to be pumping 15 to 30 gallons per minute, according to this line of evidence. We're actually pumping 50, so we're feeling good about this line of evidence. Of course, we also want to look at other lines of evidence. We usually don't want to just use this simple line of evidence because of all the simplifying assumptions. We move on to slide number 42. This is a illustration of the other type of simple calculation, which is the capture zone width calculation. The top line, let's not worry about that for now. That is actually an illustration of the equation for how you can actually draw the capture zone extent in full. Rather, we'll look at the second line of equations, the one that starts x sub 0 equals minus q over 2 pi pi. That second line of equations represents three very simple calculations. X sub 0 is what is called the stagnation point. And if you refer to the figure at the lower right-hand side of this slide, what you have is a plume. You have a background hydraulic gradient I that's going from right to left across the page. And X sub 0 is labeled there. What that refers to is the down gradient distance to the boundary of the capture zone. So in this case, immediately down gradient of a pumping well, the extent of capture immediately down gradient will extend a distance of X sub 0. And then Y max is very easy to calculate. That is the thickness from the plume the distance from the plume center line to the edge of the capture zone measured far up gradient from the plume. And Y well is a similar calculation, but it is the distance to the boundary of the capture zone from the plume center line from the near the vicinity of the pumping well itself. So you can see that the width of the capture zone gets wider as you move up gradient, but it will ultimately become asymptotic at a value of 1 max. There's a plus and minus in these equations because the calculation is done from the plume center line for the Y max and the Y well. So the actual width of the capture zone will be 2 times Y max far up gradient, and it will be 2 times Y well at the location of the pumping well. And this calculation is illustrated on the next slide, which is slide number 43. Again, we're using similar aquifer parameters as we used before, and you can see how you can calculate X sub 0, Y max, and Y well. In this case, the stagnation point will extend 225 feet down gradient from the location of the pumping well, and the capture zone width far up gradient will be, from the plume center line, will be 706 feet, meaning that the entire width of the capture zone far up gradient will be 2 times that, which would be 1,412 feet. And again, it is indicated at the bottom, there's a unit conversion that's required, because as you'll notice in the parameters that are given, the Q is given in gallons per minute, but the other, the hydraulic connectivity and the aquifer, or the saturated thickness are given in feet, and that would not be consistent units. So you see in the example calculations, the gallons per minute is converted into cubic feet per day first, and then the rest of the calculation is performed. That way, everything is in consistent units, which in this case are feet and days. Moving on to slide number 44. These horizontal capture zones, these simple calculations, are very easy to apply. As I hope you can see from the examples we just went through, they can be calculated in minutes. Certainly less than an hour. What they force you to do, however, is go back and review the conceptual model. How many of those assumptions do we actually meet, and how many of them do we not meet, and how badly do we not meet them? Do we know how wide the plume is? Do we know what the saturated thickness of the aquifer is? Do we know what the hydraulic connectivity is, and how good do we feel about that estimate? And how heterogeneous might our system be? So it forces a basic review of the conceptual model as part of this, so it's quite valuable. This set of relationships also, or a set of equations, also clearly indicates the relationship between the width of the capture zone and the values of some of these parameters. The width of the capture zone will clearly decrease the capture zone width will increase if the hydraulic connectivity is decreased, and the capture zone width will increase if the hydraulic gradient is lower. And the capture zone width will decrease if the aquifer thickness is higher.
Is that wrong, isn't
it? That's wrong on the slide. The capture zone will increase if the hydraulic connectivity or gradient is lower.
Lower hydraulic gradient, higher hydraulic gradient, lower.
As indicated on this slide, one or more assumptions are typically violated when doing these simple calculations. So it shouldn't scare you if that's the case. But again, because these are kind of scoping calculations and you're going to use other lines of evidence, these are great calculations to perform straight up as the first part of your capture zone evaluation, quite useful to do, and I recommend you generally do the calculation and then go back and determine how much faith you want to put in this particular line of evidence. Also, as noted at the bottom of this slide, vertical capture is not addressed at all by these simple methods. They only address the horizontal width of capture. Moving on to slide number 45. A more sophisticated type of calculation pertains to groundwater flow modeling, generally used in concert with particle tracking, and sometimes used in concert with solute transport modeling. One of the primary benefits of this calculation using a model is that the full three-dimensionality of the system can be evaluated, whether it pertains to vertical flow within a specific aquifer or whether it pertains to the communication between aquifers that overlie or underlie each other. However, the second bullet of this slide is very important. It's quite easy to be misled by pictures made with particle tracking if the person who is doing the particle tracking has an agenda and the person who is reviewing the particle tracking results does not have a full knowledge base with which to review those figures. So it's quite imperative If you are reviewing the report of modeling and a particle tracking evaluation, to have somebody assist you who has knowledge in those areas if you don't possess that knowledge yourself. One of the problems with groundwater modeling is this term listed on the third bullet, garbage in, garbage out. Many people don't trust groundwater models and avoid putting much faith in them because they think of it as a garbage in, garbage out. We don't know what the value of any of these parameters really are, so we can't really trust the results. You know, certainly models, like every other calculation or every other piece of evaluation we do, are subject to some uncertainty. But there are ways to reduce that uncertainty to acceptable levels, such that groundwater models can be very valuable tools. When a groundwater model is constructed, it should be calibrated. It should be calibrated to as many types of calibration targets as possible, meaning the simulated water levels should ideally match observed water levels. That should ideally be done for several different stress regimes, so different pumping wells pumping at different rates. Other calibration criteria can be utilized to add confidence in the calibration, such as the shape of the plume should match the historical water levels. Transient water levels over time observed from a pump test can be simulated with the model to prove that the model is a reasonable simulator of a pump test. Such things like that can be used to add confidence. The last bullet on this slide is quite important. Not only should a model be calibrated when it's constructed, but ideally the model predictions can be verified after the pump and treat system is in place. And the observations that are probably most amenable to that are the drawdowns due to pumping. Once you have a pump and treat system in place, you have a very easy way to perform a series of pump tests. You already have the wells, you already have the pumps, you already have a way to treat the water. So you can basically turn wells on and off and observe the resulting change in water level over time, whether it be a transient type of evaluation or whether you let that stabilize and do a steady state type of evaluation. But either way, you can do that in the field and then go back to your model and evaluate whether your model reasonably predicts the changes in water level that occur due to those changes in pumping rates. And to the extent you can demonstrate that validity, that helps increase your confidence that this model is a good predictor of drawdown. And if the model is a good predictor of drawdown, and the model reasonably represents the background hydraulic gradient, then the model is likely going to be a very good predictor of capture. The slide on the right is one way of illustrating the results of a particle tracking analysis. I'm sure many of you have seen plots that show particle tracks with arrows on them. This is a different way of doing it, where you release a particle, say, at every location, every model grid cell, and then you track which ones end up at each extraction well. And in this particular figure, what's being done is the particles that end up at each extraction well are shaded in a different color to show the capture zone of those wells. You'll also notice a target capture zone. In this case, it's a 5 part per billion contour is illustrated on the map so that the extent of capture, according to the model, can be compared to the width of the plume. If we move on to slide number 46, which is the next slide, this is a additional slide about particle tracking, which is intended to illustrate how it can be used to address some of the three-dimensional aspects of a system. The figure on the left is exactly the same figure we were just looking at. The figure on the right is intended to represent particles that are released deeper down inside the same aquifer. It's as indicated in the note at the right-hand side of the slide. In this case, the extraction wells are partially penetrating wells. They're only screened in the upper part of this aquifer. So the figure on the left represents the capture of particles that start in the upper portion of the aquifer, and the figure on the right represents the extent of capture of each extraction well of particles that start at the bottom portion of the aquifer. And as you can see, because of the nature of the partially penetrating wells in this case, the extent of capture is substantially reduced as you look deeper and deeper into the system. So this is indicating that this system, this particular system, has a three-dimensional component to it which needs to be taken into account. Particle tracking and groundwater modeling allows these types of things to be considered. It also illustrates the point I was making before about how the results of a particle tracking result can be somewhat misleading if presented unfairly. In this particular case, if only the figure on the left were presented in the report, the conclusion might be that the extent of capture is possibly quite sufficient, whereas when both figures are shown side by side, the conclusion changes to where capture is potentially only sufficient for the upper portion of the aquifer, but is likely not sufficient for the bottom portion of the aquifer. I'm now moving on to slide number 47, where I'm going to talk about the fifth step. So the fourth step we talked about was calculations. The third step was water levels. This is the other technical step, step five, and this has to do with concentration trends for water quality data. And for the purpose of discussing water quality trends, we define two types of wells, two types of monitoring wells. One is called a sentinel well, and one is called a downgradient performance monitoring well. A sentinel well is located downgradient of the target capture zone, and it's currently clean, whereas a downgradient performance monitoring well is also downgradient of the target capture zone, but it's currently dirty. The idea is, the sentinel well is currently clean and we want it to stay clean. A downgrading performance monitoring well, if it's dirty and it's downgrading of the target capture zone, we expect that to clean up over time. If we move to slide number 48, this is a schematic intended to illustrate why the two types of wells I mentioned, the sentinel well and the downgrading performance monitoring well, are both located downgradient of the capture zone. In this particular schematic, we have an extraction well, which has a red symbol in the middle. We have our plume in different shades of green and blue. And we have a monitoring well inside our zone of capture, represented by a black circle. If we have a monitoring point that's inside our zone of capture, even if the capture is sufficient for what we're trying to accomplish, the concentrations may not go down over time. As you'll notice by the flow path indicated with the dashed lines, that monitoring point has a continual source of plume material moving towards it. And when the pumping well starts pumping, the concentrations of that well might go up, they might go down, they might stay relatively the same. It's very hard to know. For a well that's located inside our zone of capture, if there's a continuing source of contamination, it's very difficult to utilize concentration trends in any meaningful way to assess plume capture. The only meaningful locations are those down gradient of the capture zone. This is perhaps illustrated better on the next slide, which is slide number 49. On this slide, the plume is illustrated with various shades of green and blue. The regional flow is from right to left. We have a receptor located at the far left-hand side of the figure. And we have a target capture zone that's drawn to be consistent with a goal of capturing the most contaminated portion of the plume with the other uncaptured portion of plume to be addressed by some other technology. We have three monitoring wells listed on this slide, MW1, MW2, and MW3. MW1 is located inside of our target capture zone. It's located inside of the area where we expect, because of the continuing source, those concentrations may increase or may decrease. MW2 is a downgradient performance monitoring well. It's currently impacted, but it's down gradient of the area we're trying to capture. Therefore, we expect it to clean up over time. MW3 is a sentinel well. It's down gradient of our target capture zone. It's currently clean. We expect that if capture is successful, that it will remain clean. If we look at the next slide, which is slide number 50, this shows conceptually what we might see if we looked at water quality over time at these three monitoring wells. Monitoring well MW1, which is the well at the top in kind of a brown color, that's within the capture zone, and because of the continuing source, it may never clean up to cleanup standards. The MW2, which is represented with the blue line, starts above cleanup standards, but if our capture is successful, this performance monitoring well should go below cleanup standards over time. And MW3, which is our sentinel well, should start at non-detect and should end up at non-detect. If capture is successful, it should not get dirty over time. This figure is, of course, highly idealized. Concentration data do not make nice curves like this at most sites. They jump up and down. However, the overall trend Another problem with water quality data being used for a capture zone evaluation has to do with the time frame. You'll notice on this figure, on slide number 50, that the x-axis is in years. It may take many, many years for these trends to become apparent. Groundwater monitoring or groundwater quality monitoring is substantially more costly and more labor intensive than is water level monitoring. So this line of evidence can be fairly expensive and can take many, many years to reach a valid conclusion. That is in addition to the problem discussed before about you really need those monitoring points to be outside your zone of capture. Many of you may be asking yourself, well, isn't that a bit of a catch-22? We're trying to figure out what our zone of capture is by doing a capture zone evaluation. I don't know what my zone of capture is, so how do I know if my well is properly placed for this type of analysis? And that does add one layer of complexity. However, you can start arriving at what that appropriate distance should be by doing some of the simple calculations we talked about before to look at a stagnation point, calculate how far the stagnation point might be, down gradient of the pumping well, or you might utilize the results of a groundwater model to illustrate how far down gradient the extent of capture might extend so you can determine where to appropriately place these monitoring wells. So slide number 51, moving on to that, this summarizes just some of the things we just talked about. To use this particular line of evidence of water quality, the wells must be located properly. If they're located inside the capture zone, they might show early declines but might stabilize above the cleanup levels. They might even go up. The concentrations might go up. So in some cases, you might have to add monitoring wells in the zone down gradient of your target capture zone to do this type of monitoring. Even if located properly, these evaluations usually take a long time. Moving on to slide number 52. This really brings home the point of using water quality data. Though these issues do complicate the interpretation of capture from these concentration trends, the concentration trends down gradient of the capture zone over time at many sites provide the single most compelling line of evidence about the success or failure of capture. If you have clean wells that become dirty over time, it doesn't matter what your model says, it doesn't matter what your simple calculations say, you've got a problem. And similarly, if you have wells that are currently dirty and you expect them to clean up over time after you institute your capture, your extraction system, and they do clean up over time, as you would expect, that's a very compelling line of evidence that capture is sufficient. Therefore, it's really important to do both, to do a combination of hydraulic monitoring and chemical monitoring. The hydraulic data, which are less expensive and easier to get more frequently, they allow for rapid assessment of system performance, but this other monitoring component of groundwater chemistry does allow for a longer-term assessment and in many cases the most compelling line of evidence. Now moving on to slide number 53. We've now talked about steps 1 and 2, which were somewhat preliminary steps. We've talked about steps 3 to 5, which were the more technical steps to evaluate the extent of capture. Step 3 was about water levels. Step 4 was about calculations. Step 5 was about water quality trends. Step 6 is where it all gets brought together to determine what is the actual extent of capture we believe has been achieved, and is it adequate with respect to our target capture zone. So in this step, we compare the interpreted capture to the target capture zone, and remember, this is a three-dimensional interpretation. We also assess uncertainties, and again, I reiterate, the question to ask is not, are there uncertainties, because the answer to that question will be yes. The question to ask is, are the uncertainties such that the entire conclusion of our capture zone analysis is in doubt? Are there alternate interpretations that would change the conclusion as to whether or not capture is sufficient? If that's the case, then those uncertainties need to be addressed by collecting additional data. As the last bullet indicates, there is also a need to evaluate whether it's appropriate to reduce or increase the extraction rates. Do we need to add extraction well locations? Can we perhaps remove some extraction well locations? That is all part of step number 6. We mentioned before the concept of converging lines of evidence. Very rarely does any one line of evidence conclusively tell you that you know how large the capture zone is or that you're successful with respect to your target capture zone. In general, if you have a water level map, for instance, that so clearly indicates that you have successful capture, odds are you're pumping a lot more water than you absolutely need to be pumping. Because usually the results are much more nuanced than that. The best approach is to have multiple lines of evidence that when put together all support the same conclusion. Every time you can add a line of evidence, it adds confidence in the conclusions. As I mentioned earlier in the presentation, pumping more, increasing the extraction rates will generally add confidence in your analysis or will generally make some of the lines of evidence more conclusive. It may make the water level map stand out that much more in terms of the extent of capture, or may make all of your gradient control pairs inward versus having some of them flowing outward. However, before simply saying that we need to increase the pumping rates, to add confidence, you need to consider the expense, whether it's feasible, and whether that causes other negative impacts. Slide number 55 illustrates conceptually the kind of approach to presenting a systematic approach to capture zone evaluation. In this case, it's illustrated as a simple table where the different types of lines of evidence are indicated, water levels, calculations, concentration trends. A conclusion from each line of evidence as to whether or not the capture is sufficient, and then comments about some of the uncertainties or other notable comments about each line of evidence. And then at the bottom of the table, overall conclusions. Is capture sufficient? Is it not sufficient? Or can we not tell? What are the key uncertainties or data gaps that need to be addressed? And what are the recommendations regarding the potential to change extraction rates or change the number or location of extraction wells, etc. Now, here it's simply represented as a table. In actuality, these may actually be chapters in a report or subsections of a chapter and may obviously refer to a series of tables and figures. So just because they're illustrated as a simple table on this slide doesn't mean that you can necessarily reduce it to a simple table at your site. It may be more complex, but this presents the general concept of presenting each line of evidence and then the overall conclusions of the evaluation. To sort of summarize this concept of a systematic approach, we presented on slide number 56 the beginning of a table, and I won't read every line of it, but the idea is it's a table that shows many red flags, that if you go through a systematic approach to evaluating capture like we're suggesting you should, that those red flags start to jump right out at you. So if you look at step number one, which is to review the site data, the last time the plume was delineated, the last time water quality was measured at this site was 5 years ago. That should raise some red flags, because do we really know how wide the plume is? Do we really know if it's vertically delineated three-dimensionally? That's a long time ago, 5 years. It also says here it's unclear if the remedy objective is cleanup or containment. If you don't have a very clear picture of what your remedy objective is with regards to hydraulic containment, then it can be very hard to define what your target capture zone should be, especially if your plume is not well delineated. So in this case, doing step number two, defining the target capture zone, would be very difficult to do because the plume is not well delineated and it's not clear what exactly it is we're trying to contain. Step number three, without going into a lot of detail, the analyst has determined that there's not an adequate number of monitoring wells to really determine the extent of capture. It also says here that water levels are used at the extraction wells with no piezometer near the extraction wells and no correction for well inefficiencies or well losses. Hopefully after this presentation, that would cause some red flags to go off in your head, that using water levels at the extraction wells could seriously bias the interpretation of the water level maps. Under water level pairs, it's indicated here that there's been no evaluation of the potential for vertical flow to underlying aquifers. Moving on to the next slide, number 57. Some simple calculations were performed at this site, and the estimated flow rate calculation indicated that on the order of 50 to 100 gallons per minute is likely required to capture the width of the plume, but only 40 gallons per minute is being achieved with the pumetry system. That might throw up some red flags. There is no groundwater model for this site to help add clarity to these other lines of evidence. The concentration trends are inconclusive, which they are at many sites. So when you get to step six at this site, you say, this is a unsuccessful capture zone evaluation. We don't have good plume delineation. We don't have clear goals. It was very difficult to draw a target capture zone because we didn't really know what the goals were. We didn't really know how big the plume was. And we did a preliminary calculation of how much we thought might be required, and we're not pumping that much. So the result of this capture zone evaluation would be there are many uncertainties and data gaps that need to be addressed. So just to summarize the overall presentation, some key concepts. The six steps presented here, they're not magic. It's not like you can take this as a cookbook and say, oh, now I have the six steps. The capture zone evaluation is just going to be easy now, because there are a lot of nuances and a lot of complexities in each of these lines of evidence, which we've tried to present here. However, these six steps do provide you with a systematic approach. They can serve as a general checklist. Do I have an adequate site conceptual model? Do I have the right types of data? Am I looking at multiple lines of evidence? Have I considered the water levels? Have I done some calculations? Am I evaluating the water quality trends? Are my monitoring wells located in the right place? By going through this checklist, if everybody would go through this checklist, resulting capture zone evaluation quality would improve markedly. And in fact, that's been observed. When Luann mentioned early in this presentation that the RSEs, the initial 20 RSEs, 16 of them had recommendations to improve a capture zone evaluation. That's a high percentage. However, this material that we've been discussing this afternoon has been slowly disseminated through the EPA regions, through conferences, through seminars like this. And I'm happy to report that the anecdotal evidence is that the amount of sites where the capture zone evaluation is a problem has been decreasing markedly. And the Groundwater Forum, and I would like to suggest that more and more people are starting to consider using these six steps as a systematic approach, and that is having a positive effect. So using these six steps will, and using some of the language that we've talked about today, will help the overall state of capture zone evaluation. It's important to have a clearly stated remedy objective. It's very important to define the target capture zone, and that target capture zone, remember, has to consider all three dimensions. You need to evaluate the importance of vertical transport and decide what your remedy goal is with respect to the potential for vertical transport. Also remember that your target capture zone may change over time if it's based on plume boundaries or concentration contours. The concept of converging lines of evidence is important. It should primarily rely on field-collected data. And field-collected data should be used to the extent possible to validate model predictions, as we discussed earlier. Moving on to slide number 59. The need for additional field data to reduce uncertainties should be routinely evaluated, and significant data gaps that might impact the conclusions of your evaluation should be addressed. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation I would talk a little bit about the frequency of capture zone evaluation. It is somewhat site-specific, so I can't come and say, as a general rule, you have to do one per year, or it's appropriate to do it in every five-year review. It's going to be somewhat site-specific. What I can tell you is some of the factors that need to be considered. One of those is the temporal nature of the stresses. As I mentioned earlier, if you have a wet season and a dry season, you might need to do capture zone evaluations for each of those two seasons. If you have tides, you might need to do a high tide and a low tide. That doesn't mean you have to do a capture zone evaluation twice a day. It just means that you have to consider both of those time frames. Perhaps more important has to do with the flow of groundwater, the velocity of the groundwater, with respect to the distance to your receptors. If I were to tell you that your nearest receptor is 1,000 feet away and groundwater flows 500 feet per year, you'd be quite concerned about potential impacts of those receptors, and you might be inclined to do a capture zone analysis perhaps monthly or quarterly or at least semi-annually. Whereas if I told you that your nearest receptor was 5,000 feet away and your groundwater is only flowing 100 feet per year, then you're much less concerned about the temporal frequency, and perhaps annual evaluations or biannual evaluations of capture might be more appropriate for that type of site. Throughout the first year of a pump and treat evaluation, multiple capture zone evaluations are appropriate because the system changes dynamically during that first year of operation. Many sites, water levels don't approach a steady state for months. They might not even reach a steady state ever, let alone throughout the first year. Things change. Wells might become fouled over time. There might be transient off-site influences that you're not aware of, and you have to really get a handle on your system. So monthly to quarterly evaluations might be appropriate throughout the first year of operation. One or more evaluations per year is appropriate at many sites, but not all sites. There may be some sites, as I mentioned, where every 2 years, every 5 years may well be appropriate. And then moving on to slide number 60, I believe this may be the last slide. Any aspects of capture zone analysis do require hydrogeologic expertise. Many people who manage overpump and treat systems or review reports have expertise in some, but not all of these areas. I pointed out one area earlier, groundwater modeling. Many people do not have an adequate background in groundwater modeling to evaluate such reports. And it's important to seek out expertise to help you with that if you don't have that expertise yourself, whether that be a coworker, that might be a technical support person available to you within your organization or outside your organization, maybe a consultant. In any case, you really need to seek out expertise in those areas that you don't possess yourself and scrutinize the interpretation of each line of evidence and try to get beyond just what the pictures show. Try and get to the more of the technical detail and those underlying assumptions and the like to really scrutinize whether each line of evidence holds water. And I guess that brings us to our last question period.
Thank you, Rob. I'd like to remind folks if they have a question, they can click the question mark and type in their question. And if they're on the phone, please hit #6 and identify yourself and ask your question. I'll go to the phone lines first. Do we have a question? Okay, well, we do have some questions on the simulcast. The first question is from Todd Muehlhofer with El Paso Corporation. Are there estimated flow rate and capture zone width calculations available for recovery trenches which contain recovery wells?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question that's never been asked of me before. The estimated flow rate and capture zone width calculations are really fairly simple calculations, and they should apply, the same ones that we went through should generally apply to a trench that contains recovery wells. Now, one of the things I sort of didn't mention when we were talking about the capture zone width calculation is that the schematic that we used, this is the figure that had Y max and Y well and X of zero. You'll notice on that figure there's only one extraction well. And the question often comes up, what happens if I have more than one extraction well? What do I do? And the reason those are called simple calculations is because they are very simple calculations. So what's generally done is, let's say you have four extraction wells and they pump a combined 200 gallons per minute. That estimated capture zone width calculation is generally done by combining all of those four extraction wells into one representative well that's put at one representative location. And the overall capture zone width is calculated. Is that absolutely a correct way to do it? No, but there's really not a better way. So my answer to the question is, I think the same calculations that we presented here you would use for a recovery trench. It's the same. It's how much water. The estimated flow rate calculation is how much water is flowing through the plume that we need to, therefore, capture. And that would be the same whether you're using wells or trenches. And the capture zone width calculation, you would simply have to assign a representative centroid location for your trench and go about it that way.
Okay, thank you.
I should also add that if that's not sufficient, if it's too simplified for your needs, I think the obvious answer is then you need to go to a more sophisticated numerical type of model or maybe an analytical model.
Thanks, Rob. We have another question on the simulcast. When designing an extraction system, how do you calculate well spacing with respect to overlapping capture zones when multiple extraction wells are needed? And that was from Tim Mosco with CH2M Hill.
Okay, well, the question Tim asked is somewhat related to the answer I just gave, which is when you have multiple extraction wells, it's difficult using those simple calculations. There's two approaches. One approach is to do what I was just suggesting, which is you lump all the wells into one representative well and calculate the overall capture zone. The other way to do it is sort of the way Tim is suggesting in his question, which is you calculate the capture zone width of each individual extraction well and see to what degree they overlap. The problem with that is it ignores the interference between the wells. One pumping well will have some impact on the well adjacent to it. The calculations I gave in the on that schematic for the capture zone width calculation were made for one extraction well. There is a paper, a very famous paper that was published in Groundwater back in the late 80s, but the author's names are Yavindel and Tsang, I believe, and I can't give you the exact reference off the top of my head. But it presents a series of solutions for, well, what if we had two wells? What if we had three wells? And at first that sounds great, and like that would really help a lot, but it really doesn't, because those calculations presented in that paper themselves are subject to a lot of limitations. The pumping rates at all three wells have to be exactly the same. The wells have to be exactly equally spaced, and they have to be equally spaced along a line that is exactly perpendicular to your groundwater flow direction. Those simplifications are really never met. So I guess my answer to Tim is that if he really needs to, get at that rigorously, you're going to have to go to a more numerical type of model, because the simple calculations really don't deal well with the overlapping nature of it. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you, Rob. And that brings us to our next question, which is, what are the most popular groundwater models currently used? Are they free or not free of charge? And that's from Charlie Wang with Delta Consultants.
Okay, well, I mean, I try not to get too detailed into things like this, because we try not to play favorites. We're not trying to, play one against the other. But in terms of a numerical groundwater model, clearly the most popular is the ModFlow suite of models, which is, ModFlow is by the U.S. Geological Survey. It's free. However, most people these days run ModFlow and its related models, which would be things like ModPath for particle tracking and MT3D for solid transport. While each of those individual codes is free, most people run them using software to make it easier to use. And those software products are for charge. They generally cost anywhere from, $500 to several thousand dollars, depending on whether you're a student or a government agency or a consultant. That is clearly the most popular model. There are another suite of models, and again, I won't go through the whole laundry list, but there's another type of flow model out there that uses a science called analytic element modeling. I think there's codes out there called like WAM and Shazam that are all analytic element models, and I believe many of those are free. But clearly the most popular numerical model is the ModFlow suite of models.
Thanks, Rob. Let's go to the phone line. Remember to hit #6 to unmute your phone. Do we have any questions on the phone? Okay, well, we have one more question on the simulcast. Has any particle tracking been done with groundwater circulation wells? And that's from Michael Harrington with Vector Remediation.
Yeah, that's a good question, Michael. Yes, the answer is yes. A lot of people have done that. The problem with groundwater circulation wells, and this is where, for those of you who aren't familiar, if I believe I understand what Michael's asking, they're wells where, say, water is pumped, it's remediated below the ground surface generally, and then recharged at a different screen interval, usually higher up. And it obviates the need, or removes the need, to have above ground treatment. The problem with recirculation wells is if the where the water is recirculated through that, say, upper screen, is in good communication with the lower screen, your recirculation cell can usually be quite strong, such that you end up treating the same amount of water over and over again, and the width of your treatment zone can be quite narrow. And, of course, how wide or narrow that treatment zone is going to be is going to be largely dependent on how far apart those well screens are and what the vertical anisotropy is, or the you know, the resistance to the connection between the upper and lower well screens. So, yes, many people have modeled it. It can be modeled very well with numerical models, and those are the factors it depends on, primarily how resistant the material is between where the water is taken out of the aquifer and where the water is put back into the aquifer. So hopefully that answers that question.
Thanks, Rob. Are there any more questions on the phone? Remember to hit #6 to unmute your phone. Okay. Well, I'd like everyone to go to slide number 62. There you'll see there's a link to additional resources button and a feedback form button. If you go to the links to additional resources, you'll see that there are links to the documents that have been mentioned in today's training. The principal document is a systematic approach for evaluation of capture zones at pump and treat systems. And that's the one we've been referring to on which this training is based. You can download that from this page, as well as the Superfund reforms for pump and treat optimization and the two additional EPA reports. You can also download today's presentation. And we do encourage you to fill out the feedback form so that we're going to offer this Internet seminar one more time on October 8th. Any comments we have on this will be reflected in that future presentation. I want to thank our two speakers today, Lou Ann Vanderpool and Rob Greenwald, and thank you for your participation. And I hope we have you on future Internet seminars.